This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. It's a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Amy Holdsworth about On Living with Television. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So this is a wonderful book that really tries to think about the role of television in contemporary life, both in, I think, in terms of television in your life, but also, you know, kind of more broadly in people's everyday practices and their everyday lives. And I guess the place to start when we're thinking about the story that the book is trying to tell and the kind of ideas the book is putting forward is with the approach the book has got. And the book adopts a kind of autoethnographic and autobiographical approach to understanding television. And I'm intrigued to hear really why you chose that approach and why that's the kind of the framework that the book adopts to tell the story of this object that, as you say in the book, has kind of always been there in your life and in the life of many other people as well.
Sure. I mean, one of the things that I've always been really interested in television and the experience of being a television viewer, but also being a television studies scholar, were those kind of characteristics of the medium that get written a lot about, particularly in early television theory, the kind of experiences of intimacy and familiarity and repetition and duration, those kind of long-term relationships and engagements that we have with television. So really the kind of autobiographical approach was thinking about that long-term relationship and how do you capture that? How do you get at that relationship and get at those characteristics in our writing and research about television? So obviously you could take a kind of audience studies approach or a kind of longitudinal study, but that often requires, you know, time and money. So I thought about sort of turning it inwards a bit. And because my previous work had been around kind of memory and nostalgia, I thought, well, what if we used the life story and life storytelling devices through which to think about those entanglements of television with the everyday and particularly within a kind of domestic contexts. So that was kind of, I think, where the book really began. And I always joke that I was going to call it My Life with Television, but that sounded a bit like a kind of naff celebrity memoir. So we went for the slightly more academic sounding On Living with Television.
I mean, it is worth saying, you know, as much as it's a kind of autobiographical story, there is quite a lot of, I guess, kind of engagement with not just television studies theory, but a range of different social and kind of philosophical approaches. And this is really clear, actually. You mentioned duration, but it's really clear with the importance of time in the book, both in terms of how you analyze particular television programs and their use of time, but also because time kind of runs right throughout the book in terms of the time of like a lifespan, the time of everyday practices, as we'll talk about later, you know, the kind of moments in particular parts of the day as well. So why was time kind of important to the book? And I suppose why is time one of the kind of big theoretical concepts that you're engaging with and dealing with?
think sort of questions around kind of television's temporalities are always bound up with thinking about its textualities as well as a kind of narrative form and a kind of affective realm as well. So time is obviously really interesting for things like the characteristics of repetition and seriality that I know has been a lot of people very interested in television seriality of late. But I think it was also about a recognition of change and continuity as well, that as a kind of somebody growing up with television, recognizing that the scholar themselves are not always in the same place, that our lives are kind of can be fluid and can be subject to all sorts of transitions. So I think time was interesting for me as well, in relation to life storytelling and thinking about the significance of age and generation for the television studies scholar. So for me, television has always been there, but for older scholars, it was new. It was a novelty. For younger scholars, they'll be much more for, you know, having grown up with kind of digital TV. So I think it was a recognition of thinking about the scholar as well and the identity of the scholar. So there's a lot of writing out there about television in transition and the way it's changed over the years. But perhaps not as much that thinks about the durational experiences of the viewer, you know, as also in constant transition, you know, whether that's, you know, as a child, then as a teenager, an adult, a parent, whether they're single, whether they're married, whether they live alone, whether they live with other people, and how those, but also how those identities are constantly layering and changing as well. So I think that was one of the ways in which I became quite interested in thinking about specifically about time and temporality in relation to TV.
I mean, a really perfect example of that question of where television fits in with the scholar's life and I guess the kind of the life course as well comes in the first substantive chapter of the book, where you tell the story of Alice, your sister's life, and the importance of Disney videos within that. And I'm interested to kind of get a sense of how the understanding about the role of time, temporality, television really kind of plays out with Alice's story. And I guess in particular, the kind of ideas you've touched on already, things like, you know, the kind of repetition of particular examples from Disney, you know, the kind of the role of television within both Alice's and your kind of everyday life growing up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Alice is my younger sister, and Alice had something called Rett syndrome, which is a rare neurodevelopmental disorder, to use medical language, that only affects girls. Alice wasn't diagnosed until she was 5 or 6. So when Alice was born, she was a very normal, in inverted commas, happy wee thing. But at about 18 months, she started to lose some of the skills that she'd started to develop. And then there were issues around her kind of cognitive and physical development, and a whole host of other kind of symptoms that came with the syndrome. So in a way, the Alice's experience of disability and living with a disability was also something that really, I suppose, troubles or problematizes some of those assumptions about the linearity of time. So whilst I've just in my previous answer just kind of referred to as a scholar growing up in quite a normative way, you know, from child to teenager to adult, you know, Alice's life was very different in that regard because of the disability she experienced. So she didn't grow up in that kind of normal way. And again, I'm stressing normal there in kind of inverted commas. So her story kind of really was quite revealing, I think, of the ways in which we can challenge those models of development and growth. And certainly in the book, I use work from queer studies and disability studies and kind of feminist ethics of care to challenge some of those ideas around the kind of autonomous individual self. And to think about how our family's experiences of disability and of a developmental disability in particular kind of challenge that kind of normative script of a kind of ages and stages approach to growth. And really, I think what became clear to me was thinking about Alice's use of Disney as well was something that was also, you know, it wasn't linear. It was very repetitive in the way she would and the way our family would use Disney in our kind of everyday practices of care, but also over the kind of duration of Alice's lifetime as well. So one of the kind of frameworks of the book is about thinking about television, both in time, in those kind of everyday practices, alongside thinking about it across a period of time and using the kind of life story or the lifespan in which to think about that. So, and I think Disney's really fascinating in this regard, I think, because it's you think about all the kind of cycles and remakes and repeats and video releases and the renaissances that Disney is constantly going through. You know, the most recent one being the kind of live action remakes of its kind of renaissance period films. That I think there are these textual and temporal loops within the world of Disney in its kind of cycles of generational inheritance in particular that I kind of recognise in the ways in which our family used Disney and what Disney means to my family as well over time. So it was a really, I'd always wanted to write about Alice and her relationship to Disney because it was such an important resource for us as a family and something that she would watch endlessly and often a source of real frustration and discomfort for myself and my older sister who were sick of watching various films over and over again. But there were so many joys and pleasures in her spectatorship of Disney as well that I thought was really important to tell the world about it and to value her experiences as a television viewer, particularly when we live in a world where children with disabilities are quite often invisible, are quite often objects of pity or tragedy, rather than seeing them as individuals that have access to a whole cultural and emotional life. So that was really important for me to try and get that across as well.
These themes, I think, of the importance of time, repetition, and the kind of the focus on the everyday come through in another, I suppose it's formally children's television, but actually the way you write about it in the book is more as a kind of family television, including adults as well, which is this series, In the Night Garden. And some of our listeners might not be familiar with In the Night Garden. I don't know the extent to which it has a kind of broad sort of international kind of hit status. I know other British children's television things have been really big in terms of stuff like Peppa Pig. It seems to be a kind of like global hit. And I don't know the extent to which In the Night Garden has done that as well. But what is this show? And particularly, I guess you developed this term, this idea of it being kind of useful television as part of daily caring routines. So it'd be interesting to hear more, I guess, about both of those things.
Yeah, so I guess as I was beginning to formulate the ideas for the book, obviously mine and Alice's experiences were really central there for thinking about how television operates within kind of scenes and sites of care within the home. And sort of practices of caregiving and care receiving too. So Alice has presented one particular kind of way in which to kind of get at those kind of caring relations that circulate around how we use television. But really, I think In the Night Garden was really where the book properly began, and encountering it as an aunt to a young niece and nephew. The show itself is made by the people behind Teletubbies, and does have a kind of international presence. But it was really kind of created to respond to a particular, I suppose, potential problem within the kind of domestic environment, which was the kind of children's bedtimes, and how the programme makers recognised that this could actually be a point of real anxiety for young children and for carers as well, you know, the difficulties of trying to get children to go to bed and go to sleep. So it's really designed for that kind of particular purpose. So I think for me, it was a really fantastic example through which to explore, again, those kinds of textual manifestations on television, of the way in which television is kind of woven into the patterns and the routines and the rituals of everyday life. And obviously through this very specific example of the children's bedtime, the show obviously also fits into those kind of intergenerational rituals and traditions, you know, of the bedtime story, and the CBeebies bedtime story, you know, is obviously really key as well to the bedtime hour on CBeebies, which In the Night Garden is also a part of. You know, they often now get celebrities reading CBeebies bedtime story, and people like Tom Hardy or Chris Evans, you know, have been really high profile A-list celebrities coming in to read to their bedtime story. And I think they're really interesting examples as well of the kind of intergenerational appeal of the kind of bedtime hour, that obviously the kid, a sort of 18-month-old child, isn't going to know who Tom Hardy is. So why has he been recruited to read the story? It's often there for the, you know, often there for the mums or the aunts. So I think it's a really interesting way in which to explore, again, those kind of scenes and sites of intergenerational care within the home and the role that television plays in those. But also, and then looking at a specific kind of domestic practice, you know, going to bed, going to sleep, and again, how television is kind of folded into that practice in a very specific and a very deliberate, and I would argue, effective way.
If that's a kind of story of how television is, I guess, used as well as, you know, enjoyed, watched and experienced, there's also a slightly, you know, very different, but, you know, slightly familiar story of how television is used as part of kind of everyday eating practices. And I was fascinated by both, you know, your kind of choice of talking about eating with the television on, which is, you know, a kind of standard sort of trope in a lot of popular culture, but it's also, you know, a kind of a site of conflict in many different ways, you know, in terms of things like class conflicts around watching television and eating at the same time. But your choice of examples is really fascinating here, because you know, there's various kind of representations of eating on television that we could talk about in terms of watching families, you know, maybe something like The Royal Family, which is a British sitcom. But you've chosen how would we describe them, you know, a quite popular, almost kind of throwaway show in terms of Man versus Food, and then a much more kind of formal, you know, great renaissance of television drama and the kind of golden age of television in Hannibal. And I'm fascinated by, like, why you chose these two examples to kind of sit alongside a discussion of eating on television, but also kind of what they tell us about the story of living with television.
Sure. I mean, yeah, it just seems a bit weird as well when, like, you know, because I'm a vegetarian as well, and both shows are very much about eating meat, whether that's animal meat or human meat. So it probably seems a little bit odd that as a vegetarian, I chose to write about those two shows. I mean, the short answer is that they were the shows that I was watching when I was starting to think about this chapter, which was really about thinking about when I'd started to think about what the structure of the book might be, you know, that it was going to be based around particular practices that are often centered around the home. So, you know, caregiving and receiving, that kind of sleeping and going to bed, and that eating seemed like a really good practice to look at. So in short, they were the programs I was watching at the time. But also sort of beginning to interrogate, well, why did I enjoy watching these programs? What was it about the eating on screen that I enjoyed? Alongside beginning to think about what it means to eat with television as well, as I guess a form of co-consumption, you know, consuming the television text and consuming, you know, the food in front of you as well, and what that might mean and how one might disrupt and disturb the other. So sometimes things can be paired very well together, and sometimes they can really kind of disrupt the experience of viewing or eating as well. So I thought it was really interesting. And then when I began to investigate a bit of the literature around eating Particularly the kind of social and health sciences approaches, which we're always kind of worrying about the impact that television viewing might have on consumption of food, that it would lead to mindless eating, for example. So there was a kind of real interesting inverse there of anxieties that have often circulated in relation to television, that the domestic contest will distract from the proper, you know, viewing of the television text instead. So it was really interesting to me how those kind of economies of attention and distraction was in there in the writing about eating, as they were in the kind of writing about television. And I think also about eating as well, it was one of those things that when I talked to people about the book, it was one of the first things that they kind of brought up when I was going, well, I'm writing this book and it's about how we use television in our everyday lives and about particular practices in the home. People would almost immediately start to talk about their use of food and eating and how they eat alongside television and what they eat and when they eat and those kinds of things. So it was something that I think really opened up a lot of really interesting avenues for me. And again, to go back to Man versus Food, a really ambivalent show as well, that some people find it quite appealing. The images of Adam Rickman eating, you know, excessive amounts of food, that the food is there to look delicious. Other people find it really disgusting, both kind of morally and in terms of, you know, the effects of the show as well. So I think that kind of really ambivalent affective terrain of eating on television is interesting in terms of thinking more broadly about television as this quite multiplicitous and messy and ambivalent and complicated textual form as well. And one thing I would just say is that when I have taught this a few times to students, and one of the things that we would do, these little like eating experiments in class, where I would select particular programs and I would ask them to bring in some food and that we would eat with these programs, and just to think about that experience of co-consumption and how one can affect the other. So I'd ask them to bring in like a kind of yogurt or some kind of yogurt dairy alternative. This was always voluntary. I wouldn't force them to do it. And we would sit and we would watch a bit of Nigella making some kind of delicious ice creamy treat to eat. So everyone's tucking into their yogurt. And then I would switch the channel and it would move over to Dr. Pimple Popper. And they'd be there eating their yogurt. And then all of a sudden it would be like, oh my God, I can't possibly eat this. Because of obviously the synergy between what happens on Dr. Pimple Popper and what they're consuming. So it was just a really fun experiment in which to think about those, how one affects the other and that kind of cacophonous realm of senses and affects that television and eating with television can produce.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I mean, right the way through the book, but also in terms of all of the things we've been discussing, is this idea of home and the kind of the practices of watching television in the home, but also how home is represented on television. And this again reflects the kind of autobiographical and autoethnographic approach of the book. And the last chapter tries to think through this really by thinking about a place and how a place is both represented and experienced. And you draw on the show Last Tango in Halifax, which is a British drama show, but is also, you know, very kind of clearly rooted in a particular part of the north of England. And I'm interested in why that show kind of matters to you sort of personally, why it's a good example of how home is represented. And again, you know, to pick up on some of the other themes, is kind of messy, ambivalent, contested and complicated.
Yeah, I mean, Last Tango in Halifax, I think again, it's kind of what I was watching when I can't remember when the show started now, but I have a clear memory of being in Glasgow and watching the first series and feeling very, very homesick. And it was something that I'd had conversations with my friend Alison Pierce, who's also an academic, and she at the time was living in Newcastle, and both of us are from the sort of Leeds, Bradford area in West Yorkshire, and we're both feeling homesick. And so we talk a lot about that experience of homesick and nostalgia that the show kind of generated. But I think it took me a long while to work out why I found it so effective and what it was about the programme, and also how I might incorporate it into the kind of structure of the book, or the kind of ideas within the book. Because the other chapters are very much focused on particular kind of practices in the home, whereas this the sort of final chapter is more about the experience and the idea of home, what home is, and again, how it can be very ambivalent and home can often be very disorientating. So it was kind of about thinking about that relationship between, I suppose, where you are and where you're from, and how those two things might not always align, and that how that can create some kind of feelings of disorientation. And then in particular, how television mediates or can mediate that relationship, and how we can rub up against our images of home, or the places we think of as home on television when we're not there, and what that might mean to be both here and there, near and far, home and away at the same time. So kind of investigating those kind of experiences, and really, again, Last Tango in Halifax was the programme at that time that being set in Yorkshire kind of was and being watched in Scotland, there was all those images and the landscapes in particular that reminded me of home and the places that I wished to be. However, when I would drive back to Yorkshire, I'd never feel quite at home there either. So it was partly about capturing that sense of homesickness and disorientation. And that I think television has always been, I think, as Mimi White writes, that kind of relationship between two points, possibly even more points. And so it becomes an interesting medium through which to investigate that experience of kind of homesickness.
At the very end of the book, you talk a little bit about the pandemic and the point you just made there, actually, about, you know, television and two or multiple points. Really kind of struck me, actually, as a question about, has the pandemic kind of changed our relationship to television in some ways? You know, we might think of, you know, kind of relying more on television, or television offering kind of more potential or more possibilities. But at the same time, you know, we face a very different kind of television landscape as compared to the ones where, you know, maybe you kind of grew up with and the television having a certain kind of like rigid or set structure. And I'm interested in precisely that, actually. You know, what does the pandemic kind of tell us, almost sort of theoretically, about living with television now?
Mm-hmm. I think it's been really interesting. Aside from the, you know, the fear and the anxiety that came with living through the first lockdown, and that's the bit that really I kind of focus on in the epilogue of the book, I think it's really kind of intensified that relationship of living with television. You know, so many people relying on television when they couldn't leave the home to replace, you know, social connections, to replace activities like education or religious worship that they might have been doing outside of the home. And I think for a lot of people, I mean, as a television studies scholar, it's something I've always been obviously been very attentive to, the role that television plays and its importance and its affordances within everyday life. But I think for a lot of people, that suddenly became much more visible, that how much people were relying on television or sharing what they were watching on television through kind of platforms or particular activities like the kind of, was it House Party on Netflix, where you can sort of watch at the same time as other people. So I think it really kind of heightened and made visible the experience of living with television and how it sort of intertwines with our everyday lives. But I think it also, for me, it also really resonated with the kind of early scholarship on television and that paradigm of on the one hand, television can provide us with a lot of security and a lot of comfort. And Roger Silverstone writes about that kind of ontological security that television can offer by always being there again. But on the other hand, it's filled with anxieties, with risks, with, you know, traumatic, catastrophic content and images as well. So that constant seesaw of emotions that television and perhaps broadcasting more general can offer. You know, that there's always that fear of that breaking news moment. And certainly anyone who's watching numbers and graphs, you know, go sky high during that first wave, you know, it was really quite terrifying. And I certainly opted in that period to stop watching television, broadcast television, and to watch more content that I could control. So I knew exactly what to watch. I knew exactly what I was comfortable with watching. So it was a lot of repeat viewing. And certainly when I've talked to my students as well, they've talked a lot about watching kind of older forms of television, like you know, the kind of Friends, for example, that's been hugely popular, or going back to kind of primetime serials and finding comfort in the kind of formula and the regularity of those kind of forms of television as well. So I think lots of ways in which the pandemic has revealed so much about the role of television in our culture and in our society. But also, I think it's also revealed that the broadcast television still has a really important role to play, but that it's not a case of just moving, you know, a kind of unidirectional, you know, that was broadcast, now we're in an era of digital or online TV. But these practices are, again, are layered on top of each other, that they're cumulative, that they're, we might be switching between all sorts of different kind of television practices in the home now. So it sort of adds to that the kind of messiness of television, which again is a kind of theme that reoccurs through the book, and again something that I've always been really interested in too.
Is that something you're thinking of in terms of future research or maybe another book project? You know, there are so many questions that kind of come both from the contemporary moment, but also from some of the analysis that you offer in the book. Or have you kind of settled your accounts with television and maybe thinking about something completely different?
That's a really good question. I think, because you know, when a book comes out, you know, you're meant to talk about it, you're meant to share it with people. And I think there was a stage where I was a bit like, I feel a little bit like you say, I've settled my accounts, and I'm not sure I've got anything else to offer. You know, it's been a long process writing this book, for various reasons. But there are still questions that I'm really interested in. I'm still really interested in questions around care. And I think that's particularly something that's obviously come up a lot in relation to the pandemic, but the images of care, the value of care, care as a practice, as a part of an affective realm, as well as being also part of policy and part of television's policy world as well. You know, there's a lot of conversations a few years ago about duty of care, particularly in relation to kind of reality television. So that's something I'm still really interested in investigating, I think, alongside beginning to do more work around kind of disability in particular, and thinking about children with disabilities and children's media, which is an area that I've worked on outside of the book, but that's obviously has a kind of a strong presence in the book, particularly through Alice's story. So there are definitely threads that I'm going to pick up on in the future, I hope.